along with the entire nation. I was touched and uplifted. That moment cemented my deep bond with the president. He became for me what JFK had been for an earlier generation, an icon and an inspiration. He made conservatism optimistic and inclusive, a sharp contrast to how dark and divisive the movement would become in more recent years. The one time I saw Reagan in person was a thrilling occasion for me, and possibly even for him, although not because I was present. The last rally of his last political campaign was held on November 5, 1984. He was cruising toward a big re-election victory and decided to end his political career where it began, in Los Angeles. He spoke that day at Pierce Community College in Canoga Park, California, an unremarkable suburb full of strip malls and tract homes not far from the equally dreary suburb where I lived. I recall getting there hours ahead of time with a friend and roasting in the hot sun, waiting for the president to make his appearance. The erstwhile matinee idol was natty as usual in his dark suit, his tie in a Windsor knot, a white handkerchief displayed in his breast pocket. He only spoke for about 30 minutes, but did not disappoint. I've come to the people of the San Fernando Valley to ask for support many times before, Reagan said in that soft-spoken, appealing, aw shucks way of his, and I'd like to ask you this last time to be with us tomorrow. The crowd of 20,000 roared back, four more years, four more years. Normally, I hate crowds and groupthink, but I happily joined in. Nobody would ever confuse this love fest with the kind of hate-mongering that would become characteristic of Trump rallies. Reagan did not attack his opponent or the news media or minority groups or anyone else. He simply offered an optimistic vision epitomized by his slogan, "Morning in America." Today, by contrast, the conservative movement seems to think that it's 2 minutes to midnight and that an extremist agenda is justified in order to save the country from impending doom at the hands of liberals. I am incredulous that anyone could possibly compare Reagan to Trump. The former had dignity, grace, humor, and class that the latter can only dream of. Reagan may not have known as much about public policy as intellectuals expected, but compared to Trump, he might as well have been a political science PhD, having spent decades reading, writing, and speaking about the issues. Reagan offered hope, Trump, fear. Reagan inspired me to work on my first political campaign as a high school student, volunteering for the Ed Schauff for U.S. Senate campaign in 1986, the year that the Chernobyl nuclear reactor blew up in the Soviet Union and the Iran-Contra scandal blew up in Washington. I spent countless hours laboring without remuneration for Schauff, a young, moderate Republican running against the aged liberal icon, Senator Alan Cranston. Schauff fell just short, but the Republican governor, George Duke-Magian, was easily reelected to a second term. That was back in the days when there was a viable Republican Party in California, before Senator Pete Wilson was elected governor in 1990 and embarked on an anti-immigrant agenda that alienated the state's growing Latino population. Wilson, a far more moderate and reasonable figure, did to the California GOP what Donald Trump may well be doing to the national GOP. The Schauff campaign didn't win, but I loved the experience, even the drudge work, which is most of what I did. I stuffed envelopes, made copies, answered mail, whatever was necessary. The spirit of camaraderie among the campaign staff and the Sunset Boulevard office left a deep impression on me. I relished the sense that we were all conservatives working together to defeat a liberal Democrat notorious for his dovish approach to the Soviet Union and his hawkish approach toward Ronald Reagan. There were other influences on my embryonic conservatism, not just politics and history, but writing and criticism. The curmudgeonly and conservative Baltimore newspaper man, H.L. Mencken, who died in 1956, was a particular favorite. I savored his hilarious, stylish, and lacerating essays, even if I did not share his contempt for democracy or the ordinary Americans that he lampooned as the bourgeoisie. I was even less in sympathy with the racist and anti-Semitic sentiments he revealed in letters published long after his death. In more recent years, however, I have concluded that Mencken's skepticism about the swinish multitude was well justified. The ignorance and extremism he denounced in early 20th century America, exemplified in his view by the populist rabble-rouser William Jennings Bryan, who argued against teaching the theory of evolution, is more evident than ever in the early 21st century. I often think of Mencken's description of democracy. Democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard, when I think of the triumph of Trump. A master of the bon mot, Mencken had a description that could not be bettered of how he became a writer. He spoke for me when he wrote, "It happens that I was born with an intense and insatiable interest in ideas, and thus liked to play with them. It happens also that I was born with rather more than the average facility for putting them into words. In consequence, I am a writer and editor, which is to say, a dealer in them and concoctor of them. There is very little conscious volition in all this. What I do was ordained by the inscrutable fates, not chosen by me. In my boyhood, yielding to a powerful but still subordinate interest in exact facts, I wanted to be a chemist, and at the same time my poor father tried to make me a businessman. At other times, like any other relatively poor man, I have longed to make a lot of money by some easy swindle. But I became a writer all the same, and shall remain one until the end of the chapter, just as a cow goes on giving milk all her life, even though what appears to be her self-interest urges her to give gin." End quote. I only differed from Mencken in never entertaining any hopes of becoming a chemist or businessman. I did think of becoming a lawyer, an ambition encouraged by my father, but only because I doubted my ability to make a living as a writer. I felt the urge to write as early as junior high school, when a friend and I came up with a prototype for an unofficial school newspaper. My ambition would be realized in high school, when some friends and I would start an underground newspaper called The Forum. We loved making trouble for the administrators at Grover Cleveland High School in Reseda, California, a public school that, with its low-slung buildings surrounded by fences and its windows covered in bars, looked from a distance like a minimum security prison. The Forum's publication was suspended by the principal after we published an article accusing the mathematics department of rampant ineptitude because of students' low scores on standardized state tests. We promptly called up the Los Angeles Times and were featured in an article as First Amendment heroes. It was, of course, a lot easier to champion free speech in an American public school than in the Soviet Union. But that experience impressed on me as a teenager the importance of freedom of the press, a realization that has not dawned on Trump even in his 70s. By my senior year, I was editor not only of the underground newspaper, but also of the official student newspaper, La Sabra. I was also the Los Angeles County champion in mock trial. You might say that my careers as a lawyer and a newspaper mogul both peaked before the age of 18. I was respected by my peers, but hardly beloved. I was voted most likely to succeed, not most popular. I was a good student, but not a quiet or obedient one. I loved to mouth off in class, challenging the leftist views of my teachers at the Cleveland Humanities Magnet, a school within a school for kids especially interested in the liberal arts. With the conservative orthodoxy I was imbibing from National Review. I'm sure I was insufferable, but I reveled in dissenting. Did I mention that I was also captain of the debate team? I loved arguing with anyone about everything. My best friend in high school, who later became a lawyer, was an equally opinionated liberal, and we would spend hours happily debating with each other. When we got to college, we both went to the University of California at Berkeley, which cost next to nothing for in-state residents in those days. Our girlfriends quickly tired of this forensic ritual, but we loved it. In retrospect, I think that arguing, in print and person, gave me a way to interact with the world that I found comfortable, whereas less antagonistic interactions were harder for me because I was naturally shy. I loved getting a rise out of people, which helps to explain why I wrote contrarian, if not particularly wise, articles for the forum, such as one arguing that money can buy happiness. My experience at a liberal high school was perfect preparation for my undergraduate career as a conservative troublemaker in Berkeley, a town that never seemed to have left the 60s behind. The counterculture was the dominant culture in Berkeley, even in the conservative 1980s. The Spartacist League bookstore still sold Marxist tracts. Hippies still congregated in People's Park, and peace signs and tie-dyes could still be seen all along the main drag, Telegraph Avenue. My favorite all-night hot dog stand, Top Dog, even served its wieners with a side of libertarian politics. There would be a riot during my senior year in 1991 to protest the university's attempts to place volleyball courts in People's Park, thus recreating the riot that broke out in 1969 when the university tried to build a sports field atop the same weed-infested block that had become a magnet for drug dealers and addicts. I lived initially in Slavic House, an elegant, university-owned house on Fraternity Row reserved for students of Slavic languages. My mother pulled a few strings to get me in, even though I had no intention of studying any Slavic language, because I had lost out in the housing lottery for space in the normal high-rise dormitories that looked like Soviet workers' housing. It was at Slavic House as a sophomore that I met my future wife during a party fueled by vodka-spiked punch. She first heard that I existed when another resident told her that there was a fascist living down the hall with a Bush Quail 88 sticker on his door. It didn't take much to be branded a fascist in the ultra-liberal atmosphere of Berkeley. But while I did not hide my views, I was eager to make my mark in campus journalism, not politics. One of the first things I did upon arriving in the fall of 1987 was to head to the Daily Californian, the official student newspaper, which was headquartered in a pink stucco building a few blocks from campus. I spent much of my first 2 years covering the Berkeley City Council. It was a fascinating experience because Berkeley was one of the few towns in America with its own foreign policy. The city council was regularly passing resolutions condemning Reagan's hawkish foreign policy and Israel's occupation of Palestine. I rolled my eyes every time the council members launched into their predictable diatribes, cribbed from the pages of the Nation. I also covered numerous rallies and sit-ins on campus. Once, demonstrators occupied Sproul Hall, the campus administration building, and while I watched, they had a lively debate to figure out why. Were they asking for a nuclear freeze, divestment from South Africa, greater diversity on campus, an end to animal testing, or some other demand? In other words, protest first, cause second. This juvenile posturing increased my scorn for the left. Not that I was above juvenile posturing myself. I was just posturing from the right rather than the left. Before long, I transitioned from reporting to editorializing. In the fall of 1989, I did a semester abroad at the London School of Economics. When I came back, I ran in the Daily Cal's election to become a columnist. In true communal fashion, all the editors and columnists were elected by the staff. A lot of people were inclined to vote against me because of my conservative views. But as I recall, Jim Heron Zamora, a future editor-in-chief and a true newsman, urged a yes vote because he thought it would be fun to wind up Max and point him at City Hall. I won and immediately penned a column in January 1990 about the cognitive dissonance I felt returning from Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I saw as vindication of Ronald Reagan's Cold War policies and proof of the enduring appeal of American-style liberal democracy. The U.S. triumph in the Cold War made me proud to be an American and a conservative. While Eastern Europe is being transformed by a new longing for economic prosperity and political freedom, I wrote, Berkeley remains mired in a rigid, new left mindset created 30 years ago. Nostalgia for the politics and protests of the 1960s dominates this town's collective consciousness. The signs of it are everywhere. Note the prevalence of tie-dyes, love beads, and Birkenstocks, all symbols of a world that has not existed for 20 years. End quote. That set the tone for the weekly columns that I would write for the next year and a half until my graduation. I loved making a bonfire of Berkeley's liberal pieties, including its rent control regulations that made housing hard to find, its tolerance of homeless people that made the streets dangerous to walk, and its affection for the communist dictator of Nicaragua that made a mockery of human rights. I expressed standard conservative views, for example, attacking affirmative action quotas and supporting the Gulf War. Like many conservatives of the day, I often protested a political correctness that stifled free speech, writing that anyone who disagrees with the left is, quote, labeled pick one, fascist, homophobe, racist, or elitist. The biggest threat to the First Amendment, I wrote, comes from the left, not the right, end quote. That is a view I no longer hold in the age of Trump. My articles caused considerable consternation on campus, where conservative opinions were rarely heard. One reader tossed a brick through the window of the Daily Cal building in protest. Another sent me a bullet in the mail with my name taped on it. I wasn't the slightest bit intimidated. I loved the attention and notoriety, and the violent reaction only confirmed in my mind the rightness of my views in both senses of the word. In early 2018, I went back to Berkeley as part of a book tour, and with an hour to kill before my lecture, visited the university library to read my old columns on microfilm. Some of them I still endorse, including my criticisms of rent control and anti-capitalist conceit that reduced the stock of rental housing not only in Berkeley, but also in New York, where I would move a few years later. But some things I wrote now make me cringe. For example, my reaction to a 1990 hostage siege at an off-campus hangout called Henry's. A deranged, heavily armed gunman held 33 people hostage, killing one and wounding seven, before he was gunned down by the Berkeley Police SWAT team. In my column, I for some reason endorsed the death penalty, even though the assailant was already dead. Presumably, this was because support for capital punishment, which had been suspended by the Supreme Court in 1972 before being reinstated 4 years later, was such a big conservative cause in those days. Just as predictably for someone indoctrinated in conservatism, I resisted calls for stricter gun control. We don't need even tougher restrictions because the status of gun law has little relation with the ability of determined maniacs to acquire weapons, I wrote. Gun control only deters law-abiding citizens from defending themselves. Imagine how the outcome of the Henry's incident may have been different if one of the patrons had been armed, end quote. Was I really suggesting it would have been a good idea for some boozy customer to whip out a Glock and open up? Apparently so. Then as now, this was the conventional wisdom on the right, which exaggerates the defensive use of firearms by law-abiding citizens and minimizes their use in homicides and suicides. I joined in fetishizing the Second Amendment as a license to sell just about any gun to just about anyone, even though the historical record and plain text clearly indicate that this language was intended to prevent the federal government from shutting down state militias. It has taken me decades to break free of the pro-gun orthodoxy. I now favor stricter gun controls, which are permissible even under the Second Amendment, because the only explanation for the prevalence of gun violence in America, we have 6 times as many firearms homicides as Canada and nearly 16 times as many as Germany, is the ready availability of guns. But in those days, I faithfully echoed the Conservative Party line. While mine was an often lonely voice in Berserkly, there were plenty of other conservatives on other college campuses in the 1980s and 1990s. Reagan had made conservatism cool, and right-wing donors were funding conservative newspapers to battle what they regarded as a stifling leftist orthodoxy on campus. The most notorious publication was the Dartmouth Review, which produced the future far-right superstars Dinesh D'Souza and Laura Ingraham. As Mother Jones magazine later noted, quote, "While D'Souza helmed the review, it published a lighthearted interview with a former Klan leader, accompanied by a staged photo of a black person hanging from a tree and an assault on affirmative action titled, 'This Show Ain't No Jive, Bro,' which was written in Ebonics. Now we be coming to Dartmouth and be up over our froze in studies, but we still be not graduating Phi Beta Kappa." The Jive article caused Jack Kemp, a conservative icon mindful of the right's problems with minority outreach, to resign from the review's advisory board, end quote. The review also outed members of the Gay Student Association at a time when coming out was still a risky thing to do. One of the outed students reportedly became severely depressed and talked repeatedly of suicide. While there was undoubtedly some overlap between my writings and those in publications like the review, my college journalism was less sensationalistic and less offensive. I was not a racist. As a Jewish immigrant, I identified with other minorities. To my shame, I must admit that I shared some of the homophobic attitudes of that less enlightened time, prejudices that I have long since outgrown. But I would never have dreamed of singling out anyone for public humiliation. There were from the start sharp limits on how far I would go in pushing my political views. Provoking people for me was not an end in itself. I liked Ronald Reagan's approach, or what I took to be his approach, of offering an outstretched hand rather than a clenched fist. That was not the case with many of my conservative contemporaries who made a career of becoming ever more transgressive to get attention. Little did I suspect that this all-out assault on liberalism would set the stage for the political triumph of a boorish real estate developer who in the 1980s was regularly mocked as, quote, a short-fingered vulgarian in the now-defunct Spy magazine, one of my favorite periodicals besides National Review. In the 1990s, I felt solidarity with other young conservatives who were determined to complete the conservative revolution that Reagan had begun. My faith in the movement was strong. It would be decades before my certitudes would begin to corrode as I watched conservatism morph into something I could not recognize. When I graduated from college in the spring of 1991, shortly after the American victory in the Gulf War, and shortly before the collapse of the Soviet Union, I knew I wanted to contribute to the great cause. I just had to figure out how. Chapter 2, The Career of a Conservative. My perspective on conservatism would shift as I went from being an outsider, a fanboy on the left coast, to an insider, a professional journalist, historian, and foreign policy pundit in the Acela Corridor. I would become personally acquainted with many of the conservative sages whose writings I had grown up reading. In some cases, familiarity would breed contempt. But in many other instances, my respect would only grow as I got to know my boyhood heroes personally. At one point, I would declare that the smartest people I knew were conservatives, a statement I now regard as the height of folly. That I would say such a thing is indicative of the mindset that I developed as a quote-unquote movement conservative. I was not just drinking the Kool-Aid, I was bathing in it. I understand what Fox News viewers experience because I experienced a version of the same brainwashing myself. This was a process of indoctrination, largely self-indoctrination, I should add, that took decades and that I am only now escaping. That's not to say that I am leaving behind all, or even most, of what I believed then. Rather, as I approach my 50s, I am sorting out for myself what makes sense and what doesn't in the conservative Weltanschauung. That is not something I was capable of doing in my 20s, when I was just being initiated into the world of the right. Back then, my enthusiasm for conservatism was excessive and indiscriminate, as is so often the case with a proselyte. I could have gone to work as an entry-level reporter for some newspaper after graduation, most likely the Los Angeles Times. I had had college internships at the Times Bureau in Sacramento and the Baltimore Sun Bureau in Washington, and I had worked as the Times stringer in Berkeley. But I didn't relish covering the night cops beat or working in some dull suburban bureau, the normal initiation rituals for cub reporters. So instead, I went to graduate school, studying history at Yale University. Between my college graduation and the start of grad school, I got married to my college girlfriend. While I was taking classes at Yale, she applied to law school and got into Harvard, but not Yale. In 1992, having received an MA from Yale after just a year amid the urban decay of New Haven, I moved with her to Cambridge so she could go to Harvard Law School. Living in a small duplex in North Cambridge, this was Tip O'Neill's old district, was an education for me. In California, where I had grown up, people of pallor were an unvariegated mass known collectively as Anglos. In the Boston area, by contrast, they were not simply white people. They were Italians, Irish, Poles, Portuguese, etc. This was my introduction to the white ethnic, working-class politics that Donald Trump would exploit so skillfully across the Rust Belt. Our landlord was an Italian-American barber who had lived in this area his whole life and regarded a trip to Harvard Square, a mile away, as a journey to a strange and bewildering land. Above his mantle, he had a picture of his hero, John F. Kennedy. He was socially conservative, but strongly identified with the Democratic Party. If he is still alive, I wonder if today he might not be displaying a Trump photo. I left grad school, temporarily, I thought, to work as a junior editor at the Christian Science Monitor in Boston. The newspaper had a distinguished pedigree. At one time, it had been one of only two national newspapers in America, the other being the Wall Street Journal, and it was known for its outstanding international coverage and a sober, serious approach to the news. But the national rollout of the New York Times usurped the Monitor's position, and its costly and ill-conceived foray into television sapped it of precious operating capital. By the time I arrived, many of its most distinguished editors and correspondents had left. This was perfect from my perspective because it gave me, a 22-year-old kid, the chance to assume responsibilities far beyond my modest level of experience. I not only worked as an assistant editor on the national desk, but also wrote numerous articles, reveling in the thrill of having my byline appear in print. I had actually applied to and gotten into the Harvard History Department, but by the time it was time to go back to grad school in the fall of 2003, I decided to stay in journalism. Editing and writing was more fun than going to class and then heading to a dive bar to commiserate with fellow grad students about the awful job market for history PhDs. I knew that it would be especially hard for me to find a job in the academy because of my conservative views and interest in military history, both intellectual deviations frowned upon by the liberal professoriate. Journalism seemed like a more promising and interesting alternative. Because the Monitor was distributed by the U.S. Postal Service, it had absurdly early deadlines, around 1 p.m. in those days. I recall trudging through fields of snow up to my knees at the crack of dawn to reach the Alewife T-stop in North Cambridge to take the train to Back Bay. It was a cultural shock for a Californian, but a return to my heritage as a Muscovite. The early deadlines made it hard to stay on top of the news, so we were focused more on analysis, but in a rigorously even-handed way. For the time being, I put aside my conservative views and concentrated on learning the newspaper trade as a quote-unquote straight journalist, not an editorialist. The Monitor was strict about maintaining its neutrality and integrity, so I was trained quite differently from young writers today who are hired by click-hungry websites with the expectation that they will inject attitude and opinion into their writing from the start. Indeed, online publications such as InfoWars and Breitbart and broadcasters such as Fox News Channel RT have entirely destroyed the demarcation line between opinion and news. They peddle their self-serving fantasies as if they were reality. My time at the Monitor taught me to be more devoted to getting the facts right. Hence, I am especially offended that America now has a president who repeats the same lies over and over, long after they have been called out by the fact-checkers. One of the oddities of the Monitor was that almost everyone who worked in the home office, a massive modernist building located next to the Romanesque Mother Church in Boston's fashionable Back Bay neighborhood, was a Christian Scientist. I was practically the only non-scientist at headquarters, although many of the correspondents in far-flung bureaus were also non-believers. Luckily, as a Russian Jewish immigrant in America and a conservative Republican at Berkeley, I had had plenty of experience being a minority. I discovered that scientists were nice people, but it took a while to adjust to the peculiarities of their religion, because they believe that the entire physical world is only a figment of the immortal mind of God. They don't celebrate birthdays, acknowledge deaths people are said to quote-unquote pass, or use medical metaphors. No budget headaches for them. They are best known for relying on faith healers known as practitioners rather than medical doctors. When someone was absent from the office for a few days, you never knew whether she had a cold or terminal cancer. Either way, she wasn't going to admit that anything was physically wrong. I got tired of having people ask, when I told them I worked for the Monitor, whether I had health insurance. The answer was yes. Heretics like me could use our health benefits to see a real doctor. In truth, some of the scientists would sneak aspirin themselves. My exposure to the Christian Science faith deepened my appreciation for the diversity of America and made me realize I could like people very different from myself, even if there were far more of them than there were of people like me. I wish more Trump supporters, anxious about the changing demographics of America, would have a similar epiphany. While I enjoyed working at the Monitor, My dream was to enter the world of conservative punditry. I set my sights on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, which I had taken to reading in college. The journal was well known for its advocacy of supply-side economics, the notion that cuts in taxes and regulations can spur economic growth. It was a philosophy that Ronald Reagan adopted as his own. Journal editorials were reported and influential and did not hesitate to disagree with the more liberal views of the journal's newspages. I wasn't particularly interested in the financial markets, but the journal had expanded to become a more general interest newspaper that set the tone for much of the Republican Party. It reached a far bigger audience than a niche publication like National Review. It was, in fact, the largest circulation daily newspaper in America, with 1.7 million subscribers. I would regularly mail clippings of my Daily Californian and Christian Science Monitor articles to the journal editorial page. This was in the days before the internet and email, receiving in reply nothing more than form letters. I did not have much hope that my aspirations would be realized until one day in early 1994, when I was notified that Robert L. Bartley, the editorial page editor, would be in Boston and wanted to meet me. He was a legendary journalist who had taken over the editorial page in 1972 at age 34 and had won a Pulitzer Prize in 1980. He did not just run an editorial page. He ran his own news-gathering operation in competition not only with other newspapers, but also with the journal's news site. Bartley was one of the most influential opinion shapers among conservatives. I was intimidated and excited to meet him. I trudged through the snow to the stately old Parker House Hotel. This was where Parker Rolls had been invented for one of the more unexpected and important meetings of my life. I had imagined that Bartley would quiz me about my political views. In preparation, I had prepared elaborate disquisitions on my Burkean conservative philosophy. Instead, he preferred to talk about my work in journalism. He wanted skilled journalists, not untrained ideologues, working for him. He would later say, "Journalistically, my proudest boast is that I have run the only editorial page in the country that actually sells newspapers." Our conversation was halting and stilted. Bartley, slight and bespectacled, was shy and retiring in person, not an easy person to talk to, in spite of his perpetual Mona Lisa smile. I thought I had blown the interview until he casually mentioned that he had a couple of job openings. One, for an editorial writer on economics, the other, for an assistant op-ed editor. Which one would I prefer? Somehow, I had been hired. I was horrified at the prospect of becoming the economics editorialist for the nation's premier business newspaper. I had never taken a class on the subject and had no interest in it. Bartley was serenely unperturbed. I later learned that he liked to take writers who did not know much about the subject and train them in his way of thinking. He did not want to hire an economist because most professional economists disdained supply-side economics, the philosophy that he had embraced at the urging of economists Arthur Laffer and Robert Mundell and former editorial page writer Jude Wanniski. In spite of Bartley's confidence in my abilities to write economics editorials, I opted for the op-ed editing job and prepared to move to New York. I was thrilled to have gotten this opportunity. When I joined the Wall Street Journal in 1994, at the age of just 24, I felt as if I had already fulfilled my life's ambition. My mother was predictably proud. My father was just as predictably unimpressed. I considered myself supremely lucky to be at the epicenter of conservative politics and journalism. I had joined what Michael Kinsley had called a central cog in the vast right-wing conspiracy. It was a description meant to be disparaging, but one that we embraced. I was dazzled by new colleagues, such as John Fund, a walking encyclopedia of American politics, Paul Gigot, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Potomac Watch columnist and Bartley's eventual successor, who seemed supremely plugged into Washington, and Dorothy Rabinowitz, an unconventional woman of indeterminate age who dressed in all black and was always making amusing and acerbic observations on the passing scene. Now that I was working in the heart of the conservative movement, I got to meet its other luminaries. I was invited on a cruise around Manhattan to celebrate National Review's 40th anniversary, and I went to Bill Buckley's townhouse for dinner with him and his editors. I found the experience every bit as enchanting as I had imagined, if also a bit intimidating. Buckley was the height of geniality, but his social X-ray wife, Pat, was more ferocious and standoffish. The evening ended, as I recall, with Buckley playing the harpsichord. This was part of my introduction to conservative society in New York, a small but intense circle of right-wingers who tended to stick together in this liberal city. There was a conservative social circuit that included annual fundraising dinners hosted by the Manhattan Institute and Commentary Magazine, where big bucks donors mingled with down-at-the-heels writers like me. Modest Christmas parties for the highbrow crowd at the offices of the New Criterion. Monthly gatherings of the Monday Meeting, a networking opportunity for a motley collection of conservative activists promoting every cause from the gold standard to the horse-drawn carriages of Central Park. Regular fundraisers hosted by wealthy GOP donors such as Paul Singer and Mallory Factor to fate and cross-examine candidates for high office. Book talks hosted by the influential philanthropist and deeply learned patron of history, Roger Hertog, in more informal occasions, such as an annual holiday gala in the airy Soho loft of James and Heather Higgins, prominent conservative activists and philanthropists who were close to Newt Gingrich and other leading Republicans in Washington. A special mark of favor was to be invited to spend the weekend at the Hamptons estate of one of these wealthy luminaries. Needless to say, such invitations would be extended only to those who faithfully towed the party line. I haven't been receiving a lot of them lately from Trump supporters. I'm sure that similar pressures exist on the left that can be just as straightening. This is how all social, ideological, or religious movements police their members, by making clear that agreement will be rewarded with greater social standing and support, and disagreement punished with ostracism. This pressure is so amorphous and pervasive that, like oxygen, you're only aware of it when it is gone. My arrival as a made guy of the conservative movement was ratified a few years later in 2007. When I won the Eric Brindell Award for Excellence in Opinion Journalism, given annually to a writer who exhibits love of country and its democratic institutions and bears witness to the evils of totalitarianism. The award had been established by Rupert Murdoch in honor of the late editorial page editor of the New York Post, one of many newspapers that he owned. I received the honor, along with a munificent $20,000 check, at a dinner co-hosted by Murdoch and Roger Ailes, the impresario behind Fox News. I strained to understand Murdoch's Australian-accented mumbling and roared at Ailes' coarse humor. I could not possibly imagine then that a few years later I would be bemoaning their creation, Fox News Channel, as a pernicious influence on American life, as in fact a threat to this country's democratic institutions. In joining this conservative counterculture, I got to meet Norman Podhoretz and Irving Kristol, two of the most prominent neocons, meaning literally new conservatives. They had been Democrats who had drifted to the right in the 1960s and 1970s, and eventually became enthusiastic supporters of Ronald Reagan. Kristol was the editor of The Public Interest, Podhoretz of Commentary, two little magazines whose intellectual impact was out of all proportion to their meager circulations. I became friendly, too, with their sons, John Podhoretz and William Crystal, who were neocon royalty of a sort. Together with the well-known pundit Fred Barnes, they launched a new magazine called the Weekly Standard in 1995 to serve as a standard-bearer for a new generation of conservatives. I became a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard and spent a decade, from 2007 to 2017, as a blogger for commentary. Bill Crystal became a mentor and good friend whose genial, wise-cracking company I regularly sought out when I was in Washington or he was in New York. Perhaps because the Crystals and Podhoretzes were Jewish and could trace their ancestry back to Eastern Europe, just like me, I found myself drawing closer to these neoconservatives than to the heavily Catholic and more socially conservative National Review crowd. Before long, I would find myself described as a neocon, a term that was often used as a slur to mean Jewish conservative or simply ultra-hawk. I bristled at the description because I wasn't a new conservative, never having been a Trotskyite or even a Democrat. Neither had Bill Kristol or John Podhoretz. We were all, right from the beginning, as much as the arch-nativist Pat Buchanan, who used that phrase as the title of his autobiography. Buchanan's attacks, however, were good preparation for the routine charges of disloyalty and demands that we move, quote-unquote, back to Israel or Russia or some other country that Jewish conservatives have faced in the age of Trump. I found it hard at first to figure out how things worked at the Wall Street Journal editorial page. The newspaper not only preached laissez-faire doctrine, but also practiced it. There was a daily meeting in the doorless office of Dan Hininger, the deputy editorial page editor, but the most striking characteristic of these gatherings was the long periods of silence. This took some getting used to for a hyper-vocal Jewish kid from Los Angeles. A product of Minnesota and Iowa, Bob Bartley was so shy and introspective that he was comfortable sitting for long minutes without saying anything, just staring at the ceiling. The meetings became almost a staring contest to see who could go the longest without speaking. I had to resist the urge to fill the dead air. People would wander in and out, and nothing ever seemed to get decided, yet somehow, at the end of the day, every day, a complete editorial page emerged as if by magic. Bartley managed by indirection, making vague, cryptic comments and leaving his subordinates to intuit what he would want them to do. Remarkably enough, this hands-off approach worked. Bartley did not write editorials himself every day, but when he did, they were inevitably razor-sharp. Somehow this diffident bookworm would turn into a ninja warrior on the printed page, severing his adversary's rhetorical aortas with a few flicks of his metaphorical sword. I am similarly paradoxical, mild in person, fierce in print. My partner, Sue, would later tell me that she was surprised when she met me, having known me only through my writing, to discover that I wasn't, quote, an asshole. I advanced rapidly at the editorial page, in part because I was deemed good at my job, but also because of the high turnover. My first boss at the op-ed page was Amity Schlace. Then she left for another division of Dow Jones, the publisher of the journal, and was replaced by David Brooks. Then he left for the Weekly Standard and was replaced by David Asman. Then he left for a new TV network called Fox News. I was the last man standing. In 1998, at the age of 28, I became the op-ed editor of the Wall Street Journal. I was in charge of three signed articles called editorial features that appeared every day next to the editorials, known in house as randos, because they appeared under the banner of Review and Outlook. I fully subscribed to the views of the editorial page. Its motto was, free men and free markets, later changed to the gender-neutral Free People, and it advocated tax cuts, free trade, immigration, a strong defense, and an internationalist foreign policy. We didn't talk much about social issues. Bob was hardly a fundamentalist, but he also didn't want to offend the religious right, whose support Republican candidates needed to win, so he generally steered clear of saying anything at all on that subject. I was becoming more liberal on social issues, but I didn't disagree with his pragmatic judgment, in part because my own views had been molded over the years by reading the journal's editorial page. Bartley's obsession in the 1990s was Whitewater, a catch-all phrase for alleged financial wrongdoing by the Clintons. We ran rando after rando on the subject. One of them, who was Vince Foster, was even blamed for contributing to the suicide of a White House lawyer who had been a Hillary Clinton law partner in Little Rock. Phrases such as Rose Law Firm and Mena Airport constantly cropped up. I had a flash of recognition years later when I saw the Tom Cruise movie American Made, which featured a real-life drug smuggler and sometimes CIA operative operating out of the Mena, Arkansas airport. The evidence of Clinton misconduct was hardly conclusive, and the editorials were so carefully lawyered that it was hard for me to figure out just what they were supposed to have done wrong. I still can't say, for example, what the connection was supposed to be between Governor Clinton and Mena Airport. But Bartley was so proud of his work that he published 6 volumes of Whitewater editorials as standalone books. These editorials could be seen as contributing to the growing tendency in American public life not just to disagree with one's political opponents, but also to try to annihilate them, a trend that ultimately culminated in the election of Donald Trump, a Republican who vituperates Democrats as traitors and charges that they certainly don't seem to love our country very much. The left was far from innocent in this regard. To Bork had become a political term for character assassination after the mauling that Judge Robert Bork had received in his Supreme Court confirmation hearing in 1987. But the right certainly bore its share of guilt. Both sides used the past outrages perpetrated against their partisans to justify their own outrages against the other side. It was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, until the body politic would be in danger of becoming sightless and toothless. In the end, President Clinton would be brought low, at least temporarily, not by his greed, but by his libido. His ill-conceived dalliance with his White House intern Monica Lewinsky opened the way for the Republican-controlled House to impeach him for perjury because he lied under oath about their assignations. I shared the outrage of other conservatives over Clinton's tawdry behavior and the way he had demeaned the presidency, and I was dismayed that liberals excused his conduct. Unlike many other conservatives, however, I did not think that Clinton was the devil incarnate. He was a center-of-the-road president who cooperated with the Republican Congress to eliminate the budget deficit and reform the welfare system. I thought he was a deeply flawed man, but I appreciated the achievements of his presidency. Ever a contrarian, I decided, as one of my first initiatives as the journal's op-ed editor, to commission an article critical of supply-side economics from a Princeton professor named Paul Krugman, not yet a celebrated New York Times columnist. That didn't work out so well. Bartley saw the article on the lineup and came into my office to let me know in a soft-spoken way that he didn't want to run it. I had to call Krugman to apologize and pay a kill fee. He graciously passed up an opportunity to publicly embarrass the newspaper. There was an official liberal slot opposite the editorial page, a rotating column written by authors such as Christopher Hitchens and Alexander Coburn, and Bartley wasn't interested in seeing a lot of contrary viewpoints beyond that. His reasoning was that other newspapers, such as the New York Times, provided plenty of space for the liberal orthodoxy. He wanted the journal's editorial pages to be a forum for the right. I barely managed to avoid losing my job over the Krugman debacle. Bartley apparently thought about removing me, but decided to give the Tyro another chance. This was an early indication to me that groupthink could be just as tenacious on the right as on the left. While I could not run too many head-on attacks against the journal's editorial line, I did manage to sneak all sorts of non-political articles onto the page by authors who weren't conservative ideologues. For instance, I convinced a former hedge fund manager named Andy Kessler to write on business news, and a former boxer turned philosophy professor named Gordon Marino to write on boxing news. I have always had an intolerance of orthodoxy, even when I agreed with it, and I was interested in producing a lively page full of unexpected insights rather than simply rote repetitions of the party line. I was greatly aided in this task by an outstanding cast of assistant editors, including a young Brett Stevens and a young Kimberly Strassel. The civil war that would eventually rip apart the conservative movement would lead Brett to become a prominent never-Trumper and Kim a prominent pro-Trumper. Although working primarily as an editor, I also got a chance to write unsigned editorials. It was a heady experience for a 20-something to write in the royal we with all the eminence and majesty of America's largest newspaper behind his every word. I'm sure that the people reading my words imagined that their author was some 60-year-old graybeard rather than a 27-year-old know-it-all punk. Because our legal columnist had just left the editorial page, there was nobody to write about legal issues, so, without anyone assigning me to do it, I started to cover the legal beat. That meant writing editorials castigating ambulance-chasing tort lawyers who were blamed by the editorial page for winning unfair judgments from corporations. I even broke a story in 1996 when I went down to Houston to interview several employees of John O'Quinn, a well-known Texas trial lawyer who accused him of paying accident runners to sign up clients after airplane crashes, an ethical no-no that might have gotten him disbarred. O'Quinn had gotten rich with a good old boy swagger that he used to charm juries in backwoods jurisdictions to award his clients vast sums from large out-of-state corporations. He had won billions from makers of breast implants, cigarettes, and pharmaceuticals. This was populism for profit. O'Quinn had figured out how to monetize the resentment of small-town Americans against the coastal elites. O'Quinn's rage after my article appeared was something to behold. He sent letters to the journal calling me goofier than a road lizard and threatening to sue the newspaper for every penny it possessed. Given O'Quinn's track record as one of the most successful litigators in America, he was said to have earned $40 million the previous year. This was no idle boast. I was genuinely worried, even if I did have the journal's legal team behind me. But O'Quinn turned out to be, as they say in Texas, all hat and no cattle. No lawsuit was ever